I want to welcome you to our class on Christian influence. We're in on lesson 8. We started 7 weeks ago, and we've been covering a variety of different things. Before we do that, I gave you a homework assignment, which was to read one chapter of Proverbs each day, starting with Proverbs 15, and you should have finished up. Today's the 21st, so you would have read Proverbs 21. I know that some of you did it because some of you have given me some comments about it. I thought it was kind of interesting. Someone mentioned that Proverbs is kind of like going to Red Lobster and eating popcorn shrimp. If you look at the way Proverbs is structured, you know, a lot of times when you read something, you have to read an entire chapter to understand what's being said there. But with the way Proverbs is put together, most of it, not all of it, but most of it is in little tiny snippets. It's like one or two sentences, and you get one thought, and then you get another thought, and then you get another thought, and then you get another thought. And it's nice because not only are they quick little items that you can put away in your head, they also repeat quite often. If you go through the entire book of Proverbs and you continue to read it, you read about the same sorts of themes. Some of the things that I picked out, you know, just in the chapters that we were looking at, were things like there's an awful lot of, I mean, really the book of Proverbs is about wisdom and knowledge and utilizing those things. That's about not being a fool or being foolish. It has a lot to say about people who are fools and why they are that way. Talks about obedience. It talks about the counsel of God, respect for the Lord. It also has an awful lot to say about being lazy. If you looked in the, especially in the verses that we were, or the chapters we were looking at this past week. So that was some of the feedback that I got from some folks on. I thought that idea of it, kind of like popcorn shrimp, if you think about it, you can pop a little one, you can eat another one. It's they're little snippets, little thoughts, little ideas that you can use in your life each and every day. And I would encourage you not to view it as homework that you have to do, but Proverbs only has 31 chapters, and you can read one a day, and you can continue to do that over and over again. By the end of the year, you've gone through it 12 times. I know some people, one person, I can't remember who it was, told me that they've been doing it for about 5, 6, 7 years. They've been reading one chapter of Proverbs every day, and how wonderful it is, and the comfort you can take from doing that. So I would suggest that you continue to do that and not view it as quote-unquote homework. I'm not going to go over the lessons that we've gone through already. We've done that several times because I'd really like to get into what we want to talk about tonight. But one observation that I do want to give you some feedback on is that I have heard from an individual or two that said, "Mike, you're not teaching us techniques on how to influence people." And to that I would say, correct, because I'm not an expert in techniques. You are a unique individual. The people that you are going to be interfacing with, talking with in your family, where you work, where you go to school, in the community, wherever you go, they are also unique individuals. I can't give you, I don't believe there is any kit, so to speak, that I can give you that you can just put in your back pocket. And that's why I've been focusing on you as an individual and what you can do and how you can live your life and how that can have influence on people. I think that's the most effective way that we can look at it. I can't give you some magic formula on how you can have more influence on people, because it purely depends on you and who you're talking to. You know, one kind of person you can influence by doing one thing, and another person you can influence another way. So if that's what you were looking for, I apologize. I don't know how to do that. So this class is about the things that you can do something about, which is you and how you live your life and how that can have an influence on other folks. We have this class and next week's class, and then we'll be done. Following that will come the lectureship. So as I've told you before, the last class will be next week, and it's going to be called The Residue That Was You. And I think I mentioned what it was about once before, but if you don't remember what it was, it can be a mystery until next week. As far as the lesson for tonight, I kind of entitled it Christian Influence Outside the Comfort Zone. If you remember last week, we talked about Christian influence, and it was more focused on your home, your family, your relatives, and also it was focused on the kind of relationships and influence you can have in the local church, not the church around the world, but just the people that you interface with on a daily basis. That, to me, for most people, is a comfort zone. You feel much more comfortable probably with within your family, with your relatives, and with the people that you go to church with. But once you step outside of that, it's kind of like stepping outside the comfort zone, as it were. And so when we walk out into that kind of environment, we need to be aware of some of the things that we can do that either consciously or unconsciously can influence another type of people. So some folks here don't have jobs. They might still be in school. Most of the young ones are in class, but there's some that might still be in college. And that may be what your vocation is right now, is getting an education. Some of you might be domestic engineers working from home. And you certainly have all sorts of encounters as you go out into the world as well. Then there's the folks that go to work every day and do a variety of different things. And you run into a whole variety of people when you go into those environments. Also, there's the rest of the community that we deal with on a regular basis. They're the people in your neighborhood. Everybody's neighborhood's a little bit different. In my neighborhood, in some cases, the people that are two houses down from me, I have to go on the tax appraiser's roll to know who they are, because our houses are so far apart. I live in Palm Beach Country Estates, and we have big lots, acre and a quarter lots, and people are far away. And you don't get to know people like you used to when I was a kid. Every parent knew every kid and who they belonged to and where they went. Nowadays, you're lucky if you have that kind of relationship with your neighbors. But it also deals with when we're trying to influence folks, we're going to bump into people. If you are part of any other kinds of organizations, you might be a member of a certain kind of social club or other activities or charities that you might work with, or whatever you do. If you go to a senior center, you interface with individuals. And then there's the just everyday people that you bump into, those kind of people that were involved in your homework assignments earlier. It was purely intentional on my part to have you do that, because I knew we were going to get to this part. You know, those everyday people that you bump into, whether it's the man or the woman who checks you out at the cash register, or whether it's the doctor or nurse that you see when you go to the doctor's office. You know, it can be an Indian chief. You know, I don't know who you run into. It could be just about anybody. And these people kind of exist out in what I call the outside the comfort zone. They're not a part of your family. They're not a part of the church. But they're people that you rub elbows with each and every day. So when we step outside this environment that isn't as necessarily as loving or as safe as, say, the home or the church is, we need to be aware of some things. When we go out, we need to be aware of the fact that, I'm going to ask you a question. Are you living your religion? Are you living your faith? I told Tasha at dinner tonight when we were eating, I said, you know, there's a word, now we're in the political season, and there's a word that in the Republican area they call people rhinos, which are Republicans in name only. The idea being that they say they're something, but they don't really act like they're supposed to. So I've invented the word chino. Are you Christian in name only? Or when you live, as you live your life and as you do things, when you go out into the world, are you living your religion? Is it a part of you? Or is it just is it an act that you put on? Or is it something you do when you're only in certain places at certain times? Is it something that you carry with you and use all the time. Do you practice what you profess? You know, do you tell people, you give them certain guidance on things, but do you actually practice what you preach? That's a question we have to ask ourselves. I have an example of one. How many of you, when you go to the mall or when you go down wherever you live, have a Chick-fil-A that's near where you go? What's the one thing you know about Chick-fil-A besides the fact they have cool commercials with cows?
They're not open on Sunday.
They're closed on Sunday. And you say to yourself, boy, that's a real opportunity missed right there. That's, you know, 7 days. He's missing an entire day where the company could be earning revenue and they could really take in more money than they actually do. Well, you have to understand, I'm not suggesting that the family, the Cathy family, who started this business in Atlanta, they're not New Testament Christians, but they have a belief in Christ. And that belief in Christ has motivated them to say that when Sunday comes along, that's important. Important enough to give up 1/7 of the potential revenue that they could get. I printed this out. It says, why we are closed on Sundays. Our founder, Truett Cathy, made a decision to close on Sundays in 1946 when opening his first restaurant in Georgia. He had often shared that his decision was as much practical as spiritual. He believed that all franchised Chick-fil-A operations and restaurant employees should have the opportunity to rest, spend time with their family and friends, and most of all, worship if they chose to do so. And that's why Chick-fil-A restaurants are closed on Sundays. It's part of our recipe for success. Here's a company that's a multi-billion dollar company that's given up, is taking the stand that this is something that's important and this is something that we're going to do. This is someone who's living what they believe. It's just an example. So, you know, we've heard that the term hypocrite used sometimes. Actually, it's a word that really refers to an actor who plays a role or a part that isn't necessarily true for that specific individual, but they're playing out a part. It's kind of like having two faces under one hat. You know, if you wear a hat, you know, you're in certain situations, you have this face. If you're in other situations, you have this face. And we don't ever want to be in that situation. I mean, if you read the New Testament, you'll find over and over again when the word hypocrite comes up, usually what follows is not very complimentary at all. And in specifics, you know, who is one of the groups that really got singled out by Jesus? The Pharisees. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Said it over and over and over again. It's something that you don't ever want to be. In Romans chapter 2, when we think about the beliefs that we have and the actions that we take, they have to mean something. And in Romans 2, I'm not going to start at 17, but that's really where the thought process begins. But in 21, it says, you, therefore, who teach another, do not teach yourself. You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say, do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob the temples? You who make your boasts in law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. This is the Apostle Paul talking to a group of Jews about their conduct and the way and what they were doing and how the kind of harm they were causing by acting the way that they acted, being two-faced. My favorite psalm in the Old Testament is the very first one, and I think it ultimately describes who we are supposed to be and how we're supposed to act and how we're supposed to look to the world. It said, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of the sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaves also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. The ungodly are not so. They are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. We can't be two-faced. We can't be one way, one time. We have to be consistent, and we have to follow. We have to practice what we preach, is what I'm trying to drive at. Really what I want to get to is there's a variety of different things that we could come up with about when we go out into the world. What are some of the things that people know? What are some of the things about us that people notice that have an influence on them? So I've picked out five different areas. And I'm sure if we sat down and we talked, we could probably come up with another five or ten. And each one of these, you could probably come up with a whole variety of additional examples. But because of the limited time we have, we'll just talk about a few of these. Keeping in mind that we want to be aware that when we go out into the world that people notice what we do. So the areas that I picked out for us to take a look at are, first one is appearance. The second one is speech. Third one is the kind of attitude that we project, our behavior, and then our demeanor. And some of these, you could probably put these things in a couple of these categories because they kind of cross over in places. But let's take a look at appearance first. I want to start with if you're familiar with 1 Samuel 16, let me set the scene for you. Saul has just fallen, and basically God has said he regretted the fact that he had made Saul the king of Israel. They had were told to conquer the Amalekites, to not take anything, to kill everyone, to slay everyone, and not to keep any of the spoils. And when they went in there, the people kept some of the best livestock, sheep. They kept a variety of things, and they didn't kill the king. And Saul got in a considerable amount of trouble for not following what God specifically told him to do. And as a result of doing that, God rejected him as king of Israel. And then we get to the point where God then tells Samuel, this is what I want you to do. I want you to go to Jesse, who's the father of David, who ultimately becomes the next king of Israel. He says, I want you to go to Jesse, and I want you to anoint the next person who's going to be the chosen one to be the king. So Samuel's a little concerned. He says, well, if I go and Saul finds out about it, he'll have me killed. So he tells them to take a sacrifice for them and tell them that you're going to have the sacrifice and fight Jesse to the sacrifice. And Jesse comes and he brings his sons with him. And it's interesting when you get to a certain point in the dialogue where Samuel makes an assumption. He gets in and the first son who stands up before him apparently was a very impressive individual. And Samuel makes the assumption, well, this must be the guy. And God goes, no. And in Samuel 16, in verse 7, he says, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as men sees, for men looks at the outer or the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. When God takes a look at you and me and everybody else, he looks on the inside. He's not looking at the wrapper on the outside. Unfortunately, we live in a world that doesn't, we don't have the capabilities that God have. I can't look inside you. You can't look inside me. I can't know what's in your heart. You can't know what's in my heart the way God can know it. we had this discussion before about you can look at the fruits that people produce, and that gives you some insight into what's inside a person. But you don't see the inside of a person like God sees them. So man has a tendency to do what? When he looks at someone, the first time you see someone for the first time, what happens?
Yeah, you make assumptions about them.
You take a look at somebody and you go, well, just based on the way they look and all these things click in your head, this person is a good person, this person is, I don't know, looks kind of shaky. You can go through a whole variety of inputs in your head as to what that first impression is. You know, when you're told, when you tell your kids, you know, it's important the first time you meet somebody to look a certain way and act a certain way, because that first impression, if you don't make a good first impression, it's difficult to overcome that. And people make value judgments about you simply by the way you look. Now, God would prefer that we wouldn't do that, but we can only have a limited ability as compared to the kind of ability that he has. But we have to be careful that when we do this, that we don't allow that first impression to be the only impression that we allow ourselves to think about another person. When you're out in the world, and this is always one of those topics you bring up that I'll get some comments about later on, but when it comes to appearance, the Bible has some interesting things to say about what you wear. I'll give you an example from the Old Testament, which isn't in force today that I'm aware of, because it was nailed to the cross with Christ, along with the rest of the old law. But in Deuteronomy 22 and 5, I wasn't really aware of the fact that God gave this provision. He said he didn't want men wearing women's clothing, and he didn't want women wearing men's clothing. And some people today use that scripture to say, well, that's why women can't wear pants. Well, that's silly. First of all, that law was part of the old law, and my recollection would be back at the time that this was written, I don't think anybody wore pants. They wore cloaks. They wore other kinds of garments. They didn't wear what we wear. And that's not a scripture that you can use to point at a lady and go, she's got pants on, and that's sinful. That's not what we're trying to get at. But what we do see in the New Testament in a couple places is, as it relates to dress, there's one topic that seems to come up a couple different times. Anyone want to take a shot at what it is? She mouthed it. You can say it.
Modesty.
God has something to say about modesty. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9, talks about modest apparel that women should wear. Does that mean men are precluded from not being modest? No. Why is it important that a man or a woman needs to be modest? They're Christians, but if you dress in an immodest fashion, what can be the end result or the side effect of you not dressing modestly?
Lustful thoughts.
Okay, you can make somebody else stumble. You know, it clearly says in Romans 14 and 21 that we are not to do things that make our brother stumble. We have to be careful that when we go out, we're appropriately dressed based upon where we're going, what we're doing. I have some examples here. Some of the men will be familiar with this, although I got to tell you that I'm not sure how many guys read this anymore when I send it out every week, because it's the same thing. This is the email that I send out to the men that are going to be ushers each week. And in the middle, I'm not going to read you the whole thing because it's not exciting, but in the middle it says, ushers must wear attire that is befitting their role. A collared dress shirt, trousers, dress socks, dress shoes, in parentheses, no sandals, are appropriate as a minimum. Casual attire is not acceptable. And you're going to go, well, where's the scripture that goes with that, Mike? We're supposed to be doing things decently in order. When we come to this building on Sunday morning, we come here to worship God. We should be wearing the nicest clothes that we have. You're standing before the creator of the world. You're not going to the beach. I can't tell you, I mean, it's amazing to me. I've been doing the coordination job for the worship service for about 10 years now. And I feel silly that I have to tell grown men to go in the bathroom and tuck in their shirt, or to tell them, no, you're not going to serve at the Lord's table with that T-shirt on that has that funky picture and those words that I wouldn't want you to wear no matter where you went. Or, oh, you can't serve because, you know, you're not going to wear the jeans and the flip-flops because you're not at the beach. There's appropriate dress, whether it's here or whether it's at work or whether it's when you go out in the community. And the whole focus of it is supposed to be that when someone looks at you, they're not influenced in the negative way, but rather in the positive way. This one I'll bring up. This is when you've worked long enough and you've had enough people work for you, all sorts of things come up. I almost feel like I don't need to say it, but you know, in addition to how you dress, personal hygiene is also something you need to be aware of. And I'll tell you a story by way of this. I had a guy who worked for me. I'll just use his first name. His name was Albert. Albert was a computer technician. He worked in the MIS department, which was one of the departments that I had that I managed. Albert was a great technician. My phone rang one day, and I picked up the phone. It was a lady who was downstairs who managed a bunch of people downstairs. She said, you have to do something about Albert. I said, what do you mean? She says, well, Susie's outside in the parking lot, and she's getting sick. I said, well, send her home. He goes, you don't understand. Albert smells really bad. Albert had really bad personal hygiene. It got so bad that we actually had to come up with a protocol just for him, which was if he went, he forgot to take a shower or change his clothes or whatever. If he came to work and anybody complained about it, we had a protocol he had to go through. He had to go back home, he had to take a shower, had to change his clothes. And we went through this over and over and over again. But what do you think the people that interfaced with Albert thought? What do you think I thought? He worked for me. I was totally embarrassed for him. But we have to be mindful of not only what we wear, but you know, there's the personal hygiene aspect of it that we need to be concerned with as well. Let's move on to another area for just a second. And I'm just hitting highlights on some of these. There's a whole lot of we could have entire classes on just some of these different things. What about speech? Before I want to categorize this a little bit more broadly than just the words that come out of your mouth. When we think of speech, right? Well, that's when we see a person that's in a situation where they might be homeless and hygiene might be an issue, the kind of clothing that they have on, maybe some of their behavior may be different to us. We have to be sensitive to the fact that they're in a certain kind of situation and that we don't make that inference of the value of the individuals based on what they look like, what they smell like, all those things. And you're right, we have to be careful when we make those kind of judgments about people. And that's why I'm saying we have to be careful not... because the rest of the world is going to go look at that person and they're going to go, you know, let's go push him aside over here because he's not important. That's a good point.
I think another thing that's about... I don't know, just thought about it.
No, that's good. Good feedback. Speech. Now, when we think of speech, we think of what comes out of your mouth and what gets communicated from you to someone else. And I got to thinking about it a little bit today after I put some of these points together, and it dawned on me that we kind of live in an era today where speech goes beyond what comes out of your mouth. If you've ever go over to the food court at the mall and you sit there, it's a real adventure in sociology when you look at people sitting there. The number of people that are like this the whole time, doing, you know, they're texting, they're Facebooking, they're Twittering, they're, I don't know, whatever else people do. But those are, in a sense, they're a form of communication, and they're kind of like speech. They're a little different in that when I say something, unless someone records it and keeps it, it kind of disappears into the air, so to speak. But when you text something, or when you Facebook something, or when you Twitter something, it never, ever, ever goes away. And not only that, but if you think you are communicating with you and another person, I can assure you, depending upon what you communicate, there are other people that are listening as well. You say the wrong sort of thing in this day and age, somebody from Homeland Security might come and visit you. So we have to expand our kind of our definition of speech and how we can influence people to include not only what comes out of our mouth, but some of these other modern technology things that are somewhat almost an equivalent to speech. I think we're all familiar with James chapter 3, and it talks about the tongue. You know, and the tongue is a very small part of your body, but it can cause all sorts of problems and issues. Let's turn over to James 3. Really, it's 8 o'clock already. Wow. It talks about the chapter 3, let's start at verse 1. It says, "My brethren, do not let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body." How many people in here have never stumbled in word? I don't believe I can raise my hand to that one. I don't even think I can say that about just today. We all stumble in word. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. And look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a small member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a small fire kindleth. The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set amongst our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. It goes on. We have to be careful what comes out of our mouth. We have, you know, the person who controls this is you. We have to be mindful of the fact that what comes out of our mouth is not bitter, is not hateful, is not mean, but rather that it's kind. You know, we have to be truthful with what comes out of our mouth. In Matthew 5, it talks about let your yeas be yeas and your nays be nays. It was talking about taking oaths, people taking oaths, but we have to be honest and truthful when we talk. Some of those, if you go back and look at those verses or those chapters I asked you to read in Proverbs, there's at least 8 different little pieces in there that talk about your speech and about your talk and about your tongue and all the problems it can cause if you're not careful. We're not going to get through everything here. I want to hop down one, too, because I think this one's kind of interesting. I want to talk about your recycling bin for a second. This falls under the category of your behavior and the things that you do. We've lived in our house over 35 years, and the people across the street, there's been at least 4 different families that have lived in that house. And it's interesting what you can tell about the family and what they do and what's important to them by looking in their recycling bin. You put it down the end of the street, and there it is. You know, unlike the trash can, it's got the lid in it, stuff's in a bag, can't see anything. The recycling bin's sitting out there, and it's open to the world, and you can see what's in it. You ever taken a look at some of your neighbor's recycling bins before? What is it filled with? That tells you an awful lot about what's going on in that house. Andre could tell you. Andre and I both have the same kind of degree in criminology. And you take these classes in investigation, and one of the things, I remember we had a trash can class, and it was a trash bag, and it was, how many different things can you tell about the person who this trash belongs to, just simply by going through the trash can? And you went through and you analyzed it, and you came up with this list of, here's all the things that you can know or potentially know. Well, when it comes to your behavior, people can tell an awful lot of things about you simply by what you leave in your wake, so to speak. And we have to be very careful about how we do that. We need to make sure that we're sowing and reaping the proper way. Tranquility is another aspect of behavior. Are you tranquil or are you a rabble-rouser? I got this handed to me in spades a couple days ago. I will tell you this quick story and then tell you what I would like you to do for homework next week, and then we'll be done. Where I live, we have these swales that drain the water when it rains so that it goes to the drainage canals and then goes out. It's a really neat system because it works backwards. My house is in the middle of the block, and all the water drains into my yard from everybody else's house. It's been doing it for 35 years. Finally got tired of it, so I decided I'd want to do something about it. So I started to work on it, but I called the water drainage people and said, you know, I didn't call them. I wrote them an email. And before I did it, this woman right here said, Michael, you know how you are. Be careful how you write it. So I wrote it, the most diplomatic thing I've probably ever written in my life. I was so careful what I said and how I said it. I asked questions. I didn't accuse anybody. I didn't say it. I just said, I really need to know how this is supposed to work. And about a week later, I got a phone call from the guy. Real nice guy. Called me up and said, hey, sure. He answered all my questions. He said, anything else I can do for you? And we had a nice conversation. At the end of the conversation, he said this. And this is the thing that stuck with me the most. He said, you know, this is the first conversation I've had with anybody from a house that lives in this, in the area that we had, where I didn't get yelled at. And I just want to thank you for not yelling at me. 2 days later, there were guys out at the end of my driveway taking elevations and doing all kinds of stuff. They're going to fix the drainage and everything else. It taught me the lesson that being gentle, being kind, being open and not being negative, not being ugly. Not that I would go out of my way. I just have a certain way of being forceful and challenging people that it gets misinterpreted sometimes. But the bottom line is, the guy's reaction was just so great. It was just unbelievable. He was so happy that he talked to me. And I was so happy that I talked to him because it was a very pleasant sort of thing. Homework assignment for next week. You're going to love this one. What I want you to do is, everybody got a copy of the new directory? Or you can only not have the new directory. You can have the older one. It doesn't matter. Everybody's got a copy of that. What I want you to do is I want you to look through the directory. I bet you can find somebody in the directory who you don't know. I want you to find somebody in the directory that you don't know. And I want you to take out a little card, and I want you to write them a little note. Tell them, you know, you notice them in church, and, you know, you can say whatever you want to say, but you get to tell them a little bit about you and let them, you know, try and work it so that when you come back the next time, you can have a dialogue with that person. So, and then, rather than handing it to them when they walk in the door, make it really special. Put it in an envelope, address it. You can address it because it's in the directory. You can put a stamp on it and mail it, because it's always so much better when you get something from the mailman. I prefer that you don't. I know the younger people, Daniel, he's going, what do you mean I can't email this? I would like you to not email it. I'd like you to write it by hand, stick it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and send it. Why don't you do that and then see what happens? You'll then have somebody else in the congregation that you now know.